Welcome, this is Doris Gilman, president of Be Seen, Be Heard, Incorporated, New York, New York, and host of Healthcare Thought Leadership one-to-one blog and podcasts for healthcare and the life sciences. The topic of this podcast is communications as part of the cure in healthcare reform. This podcast is divided into two episodes. You can learn more about this podcast guest, Gil Bash, who's executive vice president at Makovsky & Company, a global public relations and communications firm, and formerly CEO of Common Health. Click on Bio under the Links category on the sidebar. Gil Bash, in this wide-ranging interview, covers a look back where we are today and a vision of the future as communications, in partnership with education at all levels of the healthcare delivery system, impacts physicians, patients, and consumers, and takes center stage in the evolution of healthcare reform in the United States. In the second episode, Gil shares the mission of his career, which is to help patients heal.
Gil, on many fronts, the country has been in the throes of a communications revolution. There was a time when patients didn't question his or her physician's advice. Access to information on many fronts was off limits or difficult to find. You had to make the effort to go to the library. You needed research skills to find answers to your scientific or medical questions. Then you might not understand the terminology and the language in the books and medical references you found in the library. Today we have a proliferation of readily available, credible, consumer and patient-friendly outlets to learn about wellness and prevention, illnesses, drugs, treatments and cures, as well as alternatives. So my question is, whether or not we have healthcare reform in the United States in the near term, communication as education will continue and evolve in expected and perhaps some unexpected ways. So I ask you, how will communications as education be shaped by healthcare reform?
Doris, that's a really beautiful question, and your lead into the question was very interesting because you really talk about the genesis of the consumer advocate, the time where we had to struggle to find out information about illness or health or even who the best doctors were to go to. And now it seems that it's all at our fingertips because of the great wide internet. But just to go back a second on your opening statement, because it's fascinating, the revolution, a sea change began in about 1994, when suddenly groups of consumers who were defined as having a shared common health concern for the first time were able to come together online and communicate with each other. And I say 1994 because the AOL created this area called Better Health and Wellness, what they called part of their greenhouse groups then. And suddenly communities started to form. People with breast cancer came together. People with heart disease came together. Some diseases are joiner diseases. Some diseases are not joiner diseases. By that I mean women are very powerful connectors, always have been in a pre-internet era, and are more so today. But if we look at what was happening in 1994, we see suddenly the rise of patient advocacy, made easier and easier due to the ability to digitally connect with one another. Much like President Obama did to politics in 2008, patients were doing 14 years earlier, using the web as that tool. And what we found at that point, looking at research, is that disease, the shared disease, transcends demography. It transcends economic status, so that the wealthy person with pancreatic cancer feels a kinship to the person who didn't finish high school with pancreatic cancer. The power of their illness joins them together. And the power of communications made that joining possible. Now, of course, we're blessed to be in an era where everybody who has access to the web, whether it's through a public library or a cafe or their home, suddenly are able to reach out and throw out the question, do you know, do you have, who do I speak to, what do you think about? And that creates this depth of connectivity that is intensifying. And we see this in the context of healthcare reform, where suddenly people are coming out of the woodwork in order to connect with one another. So you asked the question, how will communications as education be shaped by healthcare reform specifically? What I can say is healthcare reform, both debate and whatever will follow, communications or the power of communications is bringing together people of political viewpoints, of disease viewpoints, of anxieties in a way that America has not seen in any political conversation in the last decade. Very powerful. As education, I'll leave you at this part of the question with this to ponder about. Whatever healthcare reform looks like, likely a large percentage of the 47 million Americans who are currently uninsured will suddenly find themselves part of a plan of some sort, whether it be private or public, beneficiaries in a plan, having to make choices, having to decide what's the best path to take for their health care, deciding on what doctors to choose, what medical systems to get engaged with, what medicines they're going to use to manage or prevent disease. The communications opportunity there for people involved in the information sector is vast, and we should be looking at this as a powerful public health opportunity.
Well, that brings up a follow-up question, which is with many of our citizenry not beyond high school, and in some cases the communication skills are at a lower level, and they're presented with the panoply of choices, that creates its own problems. And certainly that is the situation with many seniors who don't have access to the internet or have a certain fear factor to overcome in using it. So, you know, I also see what the possibilities, but there are also some things that are not so positive about given all these choices.
I think back to the famed Saturday Night Live commercials on Medicare, Medicaid, Beneficiary Services Part D. And they talked about downloading cookies, go to your web browser and permit cookies, in this whole confusing, almost comical way where seniors who are going to become part of the Part D program were baffled. And I think we're going to see a bit of that. At the same time, the senior population that was part of the Part D phenomena, they're much more sophisticated in the use of web communications than people imagine, and particularly in the area of email. And so for people involved in providing information or services, we're going to have to get this population to opt into information. Mm-hmm. They do use it. They may not, in some demographic groups, be using the full robust elements that we as creatives think of, whether it be Facebook fan areas of a particular issue or digital communications or blogging. But they certainly use it now as an alternative to the mail system. So we should not discount their using it. And we currently are seeing certainly the government finding new ways to deploy this. Now, here's some of the baffling aspects that I think you bring up. We currently have in our system, in our American healthcare system, if someone, hopefully not, but if someone has to go to the hospital, and that hospital visit involves follow-up care. So if you're one of the 47 million Americans without insurance, and you present yourself at the ER, you're admitted to a hospital system, you receive the care you needed, and thankfully, you're discharged from the hospital. Suddenly you need leave and you need a follow-up doctor. So we have the complexity, first of all, of people choosing physicians. Mm-hmm. We have the complexity of their getting their medical records moved from a hospital to a doctor's office. It's hard to believe in our electronic age that a patient cannot request that their information be sent by email to a physician. We still don't have the electronic record-keeping movement capacity that our system allows us to engage in. And that's going to be huge. Just think about from our standpoint, from the insurance company standpoint, from the health provider standpoint, the educational challenge and opportunity to train physicians, their own system, and the patient how to access your medical record. And that is going to be a mountain we're going to have to climb together as a society. And clearly, communications organizations, whether you're representing hospital systems, the payers, insurance companies, or pharmaceutical companies, are all going to have to mobilize to help consumers better understand how to make that happen.
Yeah.
We're not going to make changes otherwise.
And that's something that has to be introduced even in the school, elementary, all the way through high school, in terms of an awareness of taking responsibility for your own health.
Yes, and let's to that end, you talked about education at the primary or secondary levels of our society. Let me, as they say, blow the minds of our listeners today and say, physicians, our medical school system is built on a post-World War II model. And so physicians are trained not so much clinically, but how to deal with information, how to move information, how to get paid. We have predominantly a fee-for-service model in this country. So that means that the more the physician does, the more they can get paid. Yet, our salary-based model, which is a small component of the physician compensation system, actually, according to a report called the Dartmouth Atlas, shows that in systems like Mayo, Cleveland Clinic, Bassett Healthcare, that have salary-based physician models, not only are they among the lowest utilizers of medicines, they're amongst the highest in our nation in terms of outcomes and patient satisfaction. It seems to run counter to the prevailing system.
Yeah.
How are we going to change our medical school processes to train a next generation of physicians on different economic models and different ways to actually enter and watch patient information as a way of following patients longitudinally? We don't have that in this country right now. You have a primary care physician and a cardiologist and a neurologist and a gastroenterologist. Is the primary care physician who's charged with your health able to access the data readily to find out what's going on inside of you for your best interests? They don't have that capacity now. Who's going to train them? So it's not just our primary and secondary education.
Yeah.
It's actually the foundation, medical school education for tomorrow's doctors. It's a big task we're discussing right
yes.
now in the country.
So do you see any initiatives being taken that start to work in that direction?
I do. First of all, I see changes happening at the core. And this is very exciting. We have, for the first time in our nation, two medical systems, for instance, Columbia University's Medical School and Bassett Healthcare, which is a rural system in upper New York State that is rooted in Cooperstown, but actually covers about 5,000 square miles, that's the size of the state of Connecticut, have teamed together to create a new medical school called Columbia Bassett Medical School. And I think it's the first in the country of this nature where they're actually going to train tomorrow's physicians on different economic models. It's hard to believe that healthcare, I think it's a $10 trillion industry in this country, is the world's biggest industry in this country. The person who manages that industry, physicians, have little economic training. And so you talked about new vendors and tools. I can see waves of communications opportunities in terms of, once again, what is the role of the professional journal in educating physicians and therefore their patients? What's the role of CME, continuing medical education organizations, in embedding that into their programming? What is the role of online information, of educating patients about the differences between a fee-for-service model and a salaried model? Do they prefer to go to a health provider who's salaried as opposed to a fee-for-service? These are some of the granular changes that are going to happen. They're not going to happen tomorrow. They're not going to happen in the winter of this year. but they are going to happen soon.
Do you think there'll ever be some kind of consistency to, or standards, I should say, between medical schools, physicians? They're trying to work out even a payment system which is uniform for all insurance companies, for example, that I don't believe exists right now. So it just points out the difficulty of getting everyone on the same page.
You know, one of the things you point to is democracy is not a spectator sport. It is a contact sport. And that deals to the root of our conversation today, which is communications. And so organizations that are representing companies, sectors of the health industry, one of the things they have to consider as part of their service option is how they mobilize the constituency within that organization, whether it's a hospital system or a pharmaceutical company, to get their employees, get their staff involved in this conversation from what they want to do. And that doesn't mean a monolithic opinion that company X should say to its employees, what's in company X's best interest is that you communicate this point specifically. They can articulate clearly to their employees what's best, but under the First Amendment, they have to let the conversation evolve. Mm-hmm. But clearly, people who are involved in this industry, there's a tendency to handle the issue from the organizational end without educating their employees about what the organization is doing and why, mm-hmm. and the fact that they too should get involved as citizens in probably one of the most interesting conversations we're having on a household level in this nation right now. And I want to reiterate, I see healthcare as units of one connected. The person who's dealing with diabetes or heart disease or cancer or neurologic disorder, they're all dealing with their own specific angst. What connects them to other people in that pod, in that larger community, is that they realize that they are as knowledgeable sometimes as a physician. These are self-educated experts. And when you have, well, close to 300 million self-educated experts becoming more engaged in a conversation, it means that all the enterprises that surround them, that are involved with them, have to really rethink their position of how they're communicating. Once to their own internal, their organic communities, the people they touch, whether it be physicians and patients, payers, drug distributors, policymakers, people involved in innovation, they have to figure out how they're going to articulate why they're in this business and what they hope to get out of being in this business. So communication, despite what people might think, if an industry sector is impacted, will that be bad for our sector as communicators? Quite the contrary. The challenges we have, the opportunities we have right now, are bigger and better and more pressing than they've probably been in the last 3 years.
How will improving the quality of healthcare conversations lead to savings and better outcomes?
It's really a wonderful concept, because really what happens when we take a look at that, and I'm going to make some predictions. This is a visionary conversation, so it never hurts to make a few predictions. The more consumers understand the pluses and minuses of an approach, the more they can consider resourcing outcomes. The more they can better define for the physicians what their historic risk is. We know that if someone has a risk factor for illness, for instance, heart disease and stroke are America's number one and number three killers. Heart disease kills more Americans than the top five cancers combined. And yet, we're much more frightened of cancer than we are of heart disease. However, our rate of risk is much higher with heart disease than it is with cancer. Regardless, if someone really understands that they have a family risk of heart disease, for instance, even if they're trim and they're 45, they still have a risk. So what we're going to see is, as access to care becomes more accessible, and people realize that they fall into pots of risk and benefit, they're going to engage their physician in more proactive conversation. We knew in 2008 the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute and the American Heart Association announced that they had exceeded, they had beaten their 2010 goals of reducing heart disease and stroke by 20% by the year 2010. Based on the fact that people are more knowledgeable about cholesterol, they're more knowledgeable about high blood pressure, they're more knowledgeable about obesity, mm-hmm. and as a result of acting on those sub-conditions to heart disease, they've impacted the statistics that frighten us all. Mm-hmm. Now, if we see that sort of change and we intensify our efforts educationally, I'll give the example from the American Heart Association standpoint, they're going to undoubtedly be working hard as they always do, educating America that obesity is an epidemic. And by communicating that risk factor, if someone has a historic, a familiar risk for heart disease, what's going to happen is they're going to say, well, I'm healthy now and I'm overweight. That heightens my risk for heart disease or stroke. I'm going to do something about that. That in itself is going to reduce cost. If people know that their risk for colon cancer, a grandparent had it, a parent had it, and they tell their doctor, the doctor probably is going to schedule their colonoscopy earlier than ever before. If someone realizes that their parents had high cholesterol, they may have high cholesterol, they'll get themselves on a product that produces bad cholesterol or increases good cholesterol. Mm-hmm. So all of that information is changing our perspective of engagement on the micro level with the physician.
This concludes podcast episode 1, Communications as Part of the Cure. Download or listen online to episode 2 as Gil Bash makes a business case for investing in more effective communications with physicians, patients, and consumers.